about God and science and God and the Bible, okay? Now, there's at least two people here who've already seen this, and that is Zane and Jan. So you guys just pretend this is new or pretend you're excited, but definitely don't fall asleep, okay? All right, so I've given this lecture, I have no idea how many times. A few times. Because you know what? I'm kind of like the science guy, you know what I'm saying?
Okay.
All right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about why I, as a scientist, believe that, number one, that God has to be real, and number two, that the Bible has to be inspired by God. And just, you know, a little bit of my story. I grew up going to church. It was a very traditional denomination where belief in God didn't seem to be very important, because I remember we had a debate on whether God existed, and I took the no, he does not position, and it didn't seem to bother anybody. So I claimed to be an atheist, went off to college, and because of studying chemistry and physics, I came to a belief in God. All right, so what I'm going to do is, in this talk is divided in two parts. Part one is why I believe science is consistent with the existence of the God, essentially. And then part two will be why I believe science is consistent with the idea that the Bible is inspired by God. So two parts. So in the first part, I'm going to compare two views about the nature of reality. One is the atheist view, or perhaps the agnostic view. In fact, Thomas Huxley actually invented the word agnostic. He's famous for that. And he was known as Darwin's bulldog. And he famously said, "We're as much the product of blind forces as the falling of a stone to earth, the ebb and flow of the tides. We just happened. And man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents." And notice, he's sort of stealing from the Bible when he says, "And man was," in quotes, "made flesh." He's kind of sarcastically misquoting the Bible. So basically, this is the view that we are the result of random chance. That explains the nature of us and of all reality. That's the 1870s. A more recent version would be the early 2000s, when Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, said, "In the universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky. You won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we observe," he claims, "has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at the bottom no design." That's a very positive statement there. No design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. It just is, and we dance to its music. Now, that's a pretty grim view, but then again, if it's true, I guess you'd have to just suck it up and accept that idea. So this is the idea that comes from a non-God perspective, the atheist or agnostic perspective, which says basically everything we see is the result of just accident, just luck or blind chance, and physical laws acting just as they do naturally. The question is that consistent with what we know? I'm going to conclude absolutely not, and I'm going to show you some reasons why I don't agree with that. The opposite view would be that, suggested by William Paley. This is back in the early 19th century, where he proposed what he called the watchmaker argument. So we're not going to do the watchmaker argument. We're going to do the cell phone argument. All right. So let's imagine, you're walking down the road and you see this thing on the ground. You're thinking, blind, pitiless indifference, just accident. You know, maybe some silicon and some hydrocarbons and some gold and then the car ran over and boom, there it is. Just that is insanity. That is not a possible conclusion. I would argue that the simplest living thing has more evidence of design, is more complex than this thing right here. I'm talking about the simplest living thing. And there are people that believe these things could happen just by accident, by blind, pitiless indifference. Okay? I would say better than perhaps a cell phone might be a Boeing 757 Dreamliner. Now, this is kind of an old PowerPoint. Up until now, I had a 747. I realized they don't even have 747s anymore. I thought, I better update that PowerPoint. All right. So imagine you had a junkyard with plastic and metal and just stuff, and you know, and a tornado came through, and it just mixed everything up, and boom, out pops the 757. That's craziness. There is clear evidence of design, and I'm going to argue that the evidence for design in the universe is so overwhelming that to ignore it requires ignoring what is absolutely and inescapably obvious, to the point that the atheist is like, seriously? You actually believe that? So I'm going to use stuff that I teach, or I have to say now, I used to teach in chemistry and organic chemistry and physics classes, just some basic stuff that would be in any undergraduate curriculum to demonstrate what I'm talking about. So the idea then is design. So here's the question. Who's right? Dawkins? All right. Mm-hmm. Blind, pitiless indifference, or singularly beneficial accidents, or the idea of design, sometimes known as the teleological argument, big fancy word there. Okay, great. So let's talk about water. You could teach an entire one semester course simply talking about the properties that are unique to water. Water has these properties and no other substance does. Every single one of these properties, if water didn't have these properties, there'd be no life. And yet, water is literally the only compound that has any of these properties. And to argue chance and accident, I would say, is a questionable argument, to say the least. For example, in order for life to exist, you have to have a solvent. Life can only exist in a liquid situation. Solids can't be alive, like, you know, gases can't be alive. And that solvent would have to be able to dissolve a very wide range of molecules. In fact, it would absolutely have to be able to dissolve ionic compounds, you know, like salt or whatever. It would also have to be able to dissolve what we call covalent, non-ionic compounds. And the fact is that water dissolves a wider range of molecules than any other substance. None better than water. But water doesn't dissolve everything, because if it did, we'd be an instant puddle. That would not be a good situation. Okay? Now, so, again, water is the most wide-ranging solid, liquid solvent that exists. Next, boiling point. It turns out scientists will tell you, because of the, you know, laws of thermodynamics, that life can only exist between about minus 20 centigrade and about 80 centigrade. Outside that range, life can exist. Turns out that water is one of the very few molecules that's liquid across almost that entire range. But luckily for us, actually it's solid at the bottom part of that range, which is also necessary for life, as I'll explain. So the same molecule that happens to be the only one that has the right solvent properties also has the right temperature range of being a liquid. Next, water has a very high specific heat. All right, you say, what the heck is specific heat? How specific is it? No, it's not actually specific. Okay, all right. Basically, this means its ability to absorb heat. Water absorbs 10 times more heat than almost any substance, and more than twice as much heat as all other substances. None other is even close. All right, why is that important? Well, if it were not for the very high specific heat of water, the temperature on the Earth would go up and down by 200, 300 degrees centigrade in any given year. In which case, there would be obviously no life. All right, and that's one reason why we're going to Rosarito down there in Mexico, and it's going to be in the 70s and 60s all day long. Why? Because they're near water. So, the compound that has the highest specific heat by far of all compounds also has a liquid range exactly matching that required for life, and also happens to be the best solvent. Now, another thing is very unique to water is that the solid floats on the liquid. Right?
Yeah.
Did you know there's no other compound other than water for which the solid floats on the liquid? Which kind of makes sense, because the solid is colder than the liquid, and generally things that are colder are denser. Water is the only one. All right, that's surprising, but true. By the way, there is one metal, I think, cesium, some weird thing like that, but the only compound. Now, why is that important? The reason is when it's cold, the colder ice floats on top of the warmer water. Otherwise, in the winter, the lakes would freeze to the bottom, and during ice ages, the oceans would freeze to the bottom. End of life. Possibly, maybe bacteria might survive something like that. Not only that, water has this crazy property. Generally, density versus temperature goes like this. In fact, for all substances in the universe, density versus temperature goes like this, with exactly one exception. Guess which molecule is the exception to that?
Water.
Which, as you raise the temperature above 4 degrees centigrade, and then drops like that to make ice. Why is that important? Because in the winter what happens is you have the ice on top of the colder water, which is lying on top of the warmer water, which is below. And not only that, but water is an excellent conductor of heat, and ice is a bad conductor of heat. All of this design in order to have, and we could talk about the viscosity of water. There's all these other properties unique to water compared to other substances, but that's too technical. You get the idea. Water is a brilliantly designed, every single one of these properties held by exactly one molecule. Now, you could argue that just sort of luck, well, that's pretty lucky. Okay. Next, there's that periodic chart. Okay. Some people get cold sweats just looking at that picture because, you know, the chemistry class. All right, Garrick, are you good at chemistry? No, you're not. Okay. Now, I teach chemistry, and when I teach, I say, this guy Mendeleev invented periodic chart. It's kind of cool. I was in Kiev, and I got to teach in the same lecture hall that Mendeleev used to teach in. It was sort of cool. His statue was out there. That's kind of cool. Anyway, so I tell them that Mendeleev invented that chart, but really not true. God invented that chart. God's fingerprints are all over there. There are at least 22 elements that I know of that have a property that no other element has, and if that element didn't have that property, there'd be no life. That's a lot of coincidences.
22, you
said? At least 22. There's 22 I know of. I'm sure there's more.
Wow.
Okay, at least 22. The first one I'm going to mention is carbon. Carbon. I teach organic chemistry. And when I teach organic chemistry, the first week, I spend the entire week talking about all the properties that carbon has that no other element has. And if carbon didn't have those properties, it has to have all of them, by the way. It can't be one element has one of those properties and another one has a different one. It all has to be the same element. There would be no life. Okay? So a few things about carbon. For example, carbon forms four bonds. By the way, carbon is not the only element that forms bonds. There's actually two elements that form four bonds. Those two elements are carbon and silicon. Okay? So it's not the only one. It's one of two. But the difference between carbon and silicon is, if you try to connect two silicon atoms together in the same molecule, that molecule explodes. So that really wouldn't be very appropriate for a formula. So why is it important to have four bonds? Because unless you have four bonds, you don't have a three-dimensional molecule. If you don't have a three-dimensional molecule, then you don't have three-dimensional life. Okay? So it is essential to life to have an element, which is the central element of life, which is carbon, which forms four bonds. It's got that awesome tetrahedral shape. You want to see those things? That means it's three-dimensional, trust me. Now, carbon has a number of other properties. Another property of carbon is it's the only element that forms large molecules. Okay? The only element that can be the central atom to form molecules with dozens, hundreds of atoms is carbon. So the only element that forms three-dimensional molecules is also the only element that forms large molecules, also essential to life. And anyway, if I was teaching organic chemistry, I mentioned the fact that it forms rings and single, double, and triple bonds with so many other, but that's too much information. We're on information overload. There are a number of properties, all of which only carbon has and no other. And, all right, so one possibility is, I don't know, luck. In fact, let's ask a more fundamental question. Why are there so many elements? Atheist, why are there about 100 elements? Why? Because there's because of SP, DNF, and quantum numbers. Okay, that doesn't answer the question why. Okay, we could talk about other elements with unique properties. For example, there's iron. Okay, iron, here we go. Good old iron. Okay? Iron has a property which is, it's the only element that forms a strong magnetic field. Okay? Why is that essential? Because if iron didn't form a strong magnetic field, you couldn't put your kids' homework on the refrigerator. Joke. Okay. No, actually, that's not what it is. Because the sun, by the way, we could talk about the design of a star. I mean, the whole thing with hydrogen and helium and the fusion and the energy lasts for billions of years. That's crazy stuff, man. That's crazy stuff. But one thing is, life exists not on the sun, but on the planet. The planet needs energy. And it turns out the only kind of energy that can support life without destroying it is visible light. And it just so happens around 90% of all the energy from the sun is in the form of visible light. Okay, that's lucky. All right? But it turns out there are two kinds of radiation that come from the sun, both of which would destroy all life. One of them is the solar wind, the high energy particles. Remember we had the little thing with the aurora borealis a few weeks ago? That stuff. But luckily, there's iron, which creates a magnetic field, which is literally a force field, which makes almost all those particles go around the Earth. In fact, one of the problems with going to Mars is that they're going to have all the shielding on the spaceship so that the people inside aren't killed by that radiation. We have the magnetic field of the Earth. That's pretty cool. But here's the thing. Do you know what the most common element in the Earth is?
Iron.
Why? Because iron is the most stable element, not chemically, but the nuclear. And so having iron be the only magnetic element would do us absolutely no good unless it was also the most common element. So the most common element is also the only magnetic element, otherwise no life. And people would say, well, okay, it's just how it is, okay? No, I'm sorry, design is the only rational response to this fact, I would say. All right, we could talk about oxygen, we could talk about hydrogen, helium, all these other oxygen. The cool thing about oxygen comes in two flavors, both of which are absolutely essential to life. And then one flavor is O2, which is essential to high metabolism life. You could have life actually without oxygen, but you couldn't have animals. All right, you couldn't have animals. You could have like bacteria. All right, but oxygen comes in another form, O3, ozone. All right, and it turns out ozone is deadly poisonous to humans. But guess what? There's almost no ozone in the lower atmosphere. All the ozone is in the upper atmosphere, where it blocks the other kind of deadly radiation from the sun, which is hard UV rays. So the same element which supports high metabolism animal life, another form, which doesn't exist down here, only up there, which is the only place it could be so that we could be alive, blocks the ozone. Okay? Last one is uranium. You probably think of uranium as a dangerous substance. Actually, believe it or not, it's not as dangerous as you think. Now, I'm not suggesting you have a big chunk of uranium sitting in your living room, but the reason uranium is not as dangerous as you think is because it has a very, very long half-life. Roughly 4.5 billion years. Luckily for us, because if uranium didn't have such a long half-life, we wouldn't be here. Why? Well, one fact about uranium is that it's very, very dense. So we're guess where most of it is? In the center of the Earth, where its radiation doesn't really get us. And that radiation produces heat. If it were not for uranium having this very, very long half-life, the Earth would be cold and solid all the way to the middle. You think, well, that's a good idea, right? That's a really bad idea. Because that heat is what causes plate tectonics. Without that heat, the Earth would have no atmosphere. And also that plate tectonics sets up this massive recycling system that works over tens and hundreds of millions of years. Otherwise, the surface of the Earth would be sterile and it could support maybe bacteria, but no advanced life. So thank you, God, for that property of uranium, which is it produces heat. And by the way, the Earth is around 4.5 billion years old. And the half-life of uranium is around 4.5 billion years, so guess how much of it is still left?
Half.
All right? There you go. All right. So we talked a little bit about chemistry. Now let's talk about biochemistry. Biochemistry, I love teaching biochemistry because there's those moments in teaching a biochemistry course, I just stop. chills, hair stands up. This is so cool, so amazing. The design here. DNA, that is the most incredible design. And I'm telling you, there is no way that's an accident. There is no way. Absolutely no way. All right, DNA has this property of being such a stable structure that it can maintain information with an incredible accuracy. In fact, when scientists try to estimate the percentage of mutations, they come up with, you know, it's hard to explain. It's so stable. Anyway, maybe you've seen this in your biochem class, the A, G, C, and T, those things. Those are the different nucleotides, and three of those in combination form the code for making an amino acid, and so therefore the DNA is responsible for making proteins. And almost everything that happens in a cell is controlled by the proteins, and the proteins are made by the DNA. All right? The DNA in human beings, around 3 billion of these base pairs. I'm telling you, that is a lot of information. 3 billion letters is the amount of letters in a small library.
Wow.
Okay? Now, that's not a good model for, let's say the atheist says life just happened by a singular series of beneficial accidents. Right? Like that? Or something like that? All right, if that's true, then probably human DNA is not the best model. Let's say an E. coli. A very, very simple bacteria with 100 million. Let's cut it in half, 50 million. Let's cut it in half, 25 million. There is no living thing with that small
DNA code.
All right, so 25 million pieces of information. The probability that you could, by random chance, produce the genes for a living thing would be kind of like taking 25 million letters, throwing them in the air, and when they land on the ground, they arrange themselves so you could read it. Thank you for laughing. Because there's people that believe that actually happened. It's called atheists. The amount of information is a truly astounding amount of information. And one thing, this is a principle of thermodynamics. All right. Nature can spontaneously create order. I'll show you an example. But nature does not spontaneously create information. Nature does not spontaneously produce information. Information can only be created from information. And we're talking about a lot of information. All right, now here's the interesting thing that's worth noting. The only thing in the universe that makes proteins is DNA. And the only thing in the universe that makes DNA is proteins. So, you've heard about the chicken and the egg, right?
Yeah.
How about DNA and proteins? So I ask the atheist or the determinist or the materialist, which came first, DNA or proteins? And they say, well, there's the RNA world. That's the RNA world thing. That is an ad hoc hypothesis with no basis in fact. All right, so here's what had to have happened if our friends Huxley and Dawkins were right. That by just random molecules bumping into each other, the proteins that would have made the DNA sort of came into existence at the same time that the DNA that would have made that same protein also came into existence, because this DNA was not made from that protein, and this protein was not made from that DNA, and they both sort of spontaneously popped up, and then the living thing just started from there. Folks, this is ridiculous. This is absurd. And yet the atheist has to believe this because it's the only option they have. You might think that biologists would have a theory to explain the spontaneous origin of life. I'm telling you, they don't. Okay? They do not. They come up with these models, and none of them work, because every model they ever use, they have to put information in, because no information in, no information out. That is a fact of nature. Like I said, nature does create order spontaneously. Okay? What it doesn't create is information. All right, creating information spontaneously is like taking a big pile of playing cards with a leaf blower and trying to blow the cards with a leaf blower and make a house of cards. That will not happen, waiting for more time does not help this process happen. No, I'm sorry. Life is designed. Chemistry is designed. Biochemistry is designed. Life is designed. It's the only rational conclusion. And I'm sorry, those who say differently, I don't think they're thinking rationally. I really don't. Okay, so now let's talk about physics. We talked about chemistry. We talked about biochemistry. Let's talk about physics a little bit. Now, before the late 30s, early 40s, physicists were essentially unanimous in what was believed would be that the idea was not, that the universe was not created. The universe is eternal. Okay? Why did they believe the universe is eternal? Was it because of evidence?
No.
No. Generally, scientists come up with models or theories because evidence that points towards that model or that theory. But in this case, no, that's not why they believed in the eternal universe. They believed in the eternal universe because the alternative was so problematic for atheists. Because the alternative is a created universe. And if you have a created universe, then you have a creator. Not territor, creator. Creator. We all say creator, I know. Right. And if you have a creator, then they're wrong. About everything. Literally, about everything. And so they have a philosophical problem. So that's why up until the 1930s or 40s, the accepted model was the eternal, uncreated universe. Then, of course, you might be aware. Oh, by the way, Hebrews 11:3 said, by faith we understand that the universe was created so that what is seen has been made not from things that are visible, but from things that are invisible. The Bible all along had said the universe was created. The physical things were created by an invisible thing. Okay, then 1929, Hubble published his work talking about the red shift, showing that the universe is expanding. And basically, the farther away from us you are, the faster those things are moving. So this led to the idea the universe is expanding very, very rapidly, which led to the idea, well, it must have been smaller at some time. And somebody had the whacked out idea to propose maybe it started as a singularity. That's called the Big Bang model. Now, did physicists say, oh, great, thank you for explaining that. Yeah, no, they fought this for 25, 30 years. But then in the mid-1960s, Penzias and Wilson, this is a sort of a technical thing, discovered this background microwave radiation. So, all right, just the Big Bang model required that this event would create a flash of light which would reverberate throughout the universe eternally, essentially. And they predicted what frequency it would have and what intensity it would have. Wow. And these guys, Penzias and Wilson, in 1965, they're radio astronomers, not even thinking anything about Big Bang. They were just creating radio telescopes, a radio antennae, and they picked up this static. And they thought maybe birds had messed up their thing or maybe something like that. And they couldn't get it to go away. And he was talking to a friend of his who was a cosmologist. He said, you just discovered the background microwave radiation. Got the Nobel Prize for an accidental discovery.
Wow.
So by the late 1960s, guess what? Virtually all physicists now conclude. The universe was created. The model says this. Now, whether this is what happened or not, it's hard to prove using experiment because it's a long time ago. But the model says there was nothing. No mass, no energy, not even space or time. None of those existed. And then with a brilliant flash of light out of nothing, the entire universe came to exist. Sounds like Genesis 1:1. All right? So, now, then, in the 70s and 80s, as physicists, cosmologists tried to work out the details of what this event must have looked like, they discovered some astonishing facts. The universe it's called fine-tuned. In other words, the universe is governed by these numbers, essentially, these constants, if you will, which have to have a ridiculously precise value, otherwise life itself couldn't exist. All right, so I'm going to give you a few examples of what's called the fine-tuned universe. One of those is the size of the universal gravitational force. By the way, the universal gravitational force is extremely weak. Otherwise, I'd be walking next to Michael and he goes, you know, like, it's a very weak force. It's 10 to the minus 16. It's a very small force, but it acts over fantastically large distances. Okay? And it turns out, what they noticed was, whatever the force is, if it were larger than it is by that fraction, the universe would have collapsed almost as soon as it was created. On the other hand, if the universe of gravitational force was smaller than it is, by roughly that same proportion, then the universe would have expanded forever and no stars and galaxies would have formed. So, two questions for the atheist. Number one, why is there gravity? Help me out. Why is there gravity? Oh, you don't have an answer for that one. I do. All right, because God wanted to make planets and stars and all that sort of stuff. Question number two, atheist. Why does gravity have a value that matches the required thing to that precision? By the way, that number is essentially zero. To illustrate how small that number is, the probability that the universe would have the right gravitational constant by accident, which is what the atheist believes. All right, imagine this. Let's say Francisco was playing the lottery. You go, Francisco, that's gambling. That's not a Christian thing to do. All right. Well, we won't judge on that. All right, let's say Francisco won the big lottery.
The scratcher.
All right, he won the big lottery. You know, $147 billion. Hello. What would we say? Oh, okay, sure, yeah, great. All right, let's say he won again the next week.
What?
What if he won 3 weeks in a row?
No.
He's going to be in jail, right? Turns out, if you were to just say, all right, I'm going to set the gravitational constant to some value. If you were to choose the correct value, it'd be like winning the big lotto 6 times in a row.
Wow.
All right. If you want to go on those odds, that's kind of like the odds that the atheist is right in their view, just based on this one thing alone. And you're going to argue for that to be a singularly beneficial accident? That's a singularly beneficial accident. But then it turns out, remember those 22 elements? How about the fact that there's more than 30 parameters that govern the physical world that have a property along these lines? All right. For example, the nuclear strong force. That's what, you know, holds the protons and the neutrons together. Okay. Got it? Turns out in that case, the tuning is not 1 part in 10 to the 60. The tuning is about 5 or 10%. So it's not quite as finely tuned. But it turns out if that force was about 10% larger, there'd be no hydrogen and only heavier elements, which would be a problem because then you wouldn't have stars and you wouldn't have fusion. But on the other hand, if the strong nuclear force was weaker than it is by about 5 or 10%, then there'd be only hydrogen. That would also be a problem for us. And not only do you have that, the ratio of electrons to protons, which are produced by separate processes, the weak nuclear force, electric force, and the list goes on and on and on. If you start multiplying this number times this number times this number, the probability of this happening by accident, it's zero. The universe was designed. That is a set fact of nature. Now, physicists, of course, have to come up with an excuse to ignore this. So, not all physicists, but certain cosmologists, so they came up with this multiverse idea. All right. So the idea is there's an infinite number of universes that we exist in the correct one. Guess how much evidence they have for that?
Zero.
Zero. That's called an ad hoc hypothesis. A hypothesis formed not because of any evidence for it at all. It's done to defend a bogus philosophy of atheism. Okay. Super intellect, Fred Hoyle, has monkeyed with physics as well as chemistry and biology. Anthony Flew, the most preeminent sort of intellectual atheist in the late 20th century, early 21st century, 2004, finally said, all right, I give up. All right, sure, there's a creator God. Thank you, Anthony, for catching up with reality. We could talk about being the right kind of galaxy, the right kind of star, the right location, the right kind of planet. All right, so conclusion to part one of our talk, because there's two parts, is Romans 1:20. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. And I would say, who has the least possible excuse for not believing in God? The scientist. So don't be intimidated by bald white guys with glasses, all right? Don't be intimidated by them. They sound so confident, so confident. But it's not even rational. Okay? Now, I promised part two, which is science and the Bible. Because really, what we've established, I believe, through part A in this talk, is that there is a creator. That creator is very smart and very powerful. Mm-hmm. All right? So that doesn't mean you become a Christian. That means you become a deist, like Anthony Flew, or like Isaac Newton or Albert Einstein. But I want to use science to defend the idea of the inspiration, specifically of the Bible. By the way, the evidence for the inspiration of the Bible is like this big, and of that, the science evidence for the inspiration of the Bible is like this tiny fraction, all right? So this, in fact, this is not the reason I came to believe in the inspiration of the Bible. This talk is how I came to believe in God. But this talk is not how I came to believe in the inspiration of the Bible. I came there from other means that we could talk about if we have questions at the end. So here's a famous atheist, an evolutionist, making the confident statement, I found this quote somewhere, Christianity is scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable, philosophically suspect at best, disreputable at worst, and historically fraudulent. There you go. Just throw that out there. Okay? Fine, you can say that. So, okay, fine. Can you give me a single fact of history that contradicts a single historical claim in the Bible? Do you have even one of those? And the answer is no. So that's just a bunch of nonsense. That is not true. Philosophically suspect at best, okay? How about atheism as a philosophy? How about determinism as a philosophy? How about postmodernism as a philosophy? I will defend Christian philosophy, but that's a whole other talk. I wrote a book on that. All right, but tonight we're going to talk about Christianity, scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable. I'll tell a story. You've heard this story before. Jan's out making a phone call. She's heard this talk so many times. She's just catching up on her phone calls. Anyway. So this is a story I was at a conference. This was in Arizona. And we're in a van. There's like 8 or 10 of us science professors. Going between venues, I can't remember what it was, going somewhere. And so we're kind of sitting around in this van, and this lady, so confidently, I don't know if she was a biologist, physicist, I don't know what she was, she confidently says, you know, Christianity, what a stupid religion, such a stupid religion. Did you know that it says in the Bible, if you wear clothing with more than one material, capital punishment for that? How ridiculous is that? All right. And the thing is, notice what she's doing. She's assuming everybody in this van is with her on this. She's just assuming. By the way, not all scientists are atheists. In fact, the studies have been shown it's around 50%, something like that. And it's just that the atheists are really loud. You know, that they control the room. So I said to her, excuse me, the Bible doesn't say that. And she said, yes, it does. I found it at this website. Okay. There you go. That's really proof. So, all right, guess what I did? I pulled out my Bible. I had a Bible on me. I don't know why I had my Bible on me because we're going to this talk. And I kind of, all right, Leviticus. I know it's a Leviticus. I remember it being on the right-hand side of the page. Could you find that verse? Could you find that verse? Do you know your Bible? What? Could you find that verse? Because there's a verse about wearing. Yeah, so I read it.
2 minutes.
All right. I read it. And I said, you know, people say the Bible is full of all kinds of science errors. I said, I've read the Bible through, I don't know, a few times. I haven't found one yet. I don't know what they're talking about. A little quiet in that van, and then we just moved on and talked about, I don't know what. Okay. So my point is, don't be intimidated by these smart-seeming enemies of the Bible. Because generally, they don't know what they're talking about. Okay? So here's an example. Papyrus Ebers. This is Manny's saying, I can't read that. What's that saying? It's in some kind of, hieroglyphic language there. What it is, it's a compendium of medical knowledge from Egypt in around the 14th, 15th century BC. which is relevant for our discussion because that's kind of around the time of Moses. And, you know, medical historians would tell you the greatest medical knowledge in the ancient world was probably China and Egypt. Those kind of had, they had all this interesting stuff. So let's look at some of the prescriptions in Papyrus Ebers. To prevent hair from turning gray, anointed with the blood of a calf, which has been boiled in oil, or the fat of a rattlesnake. Manny, have you been using that stuff?
Have you been using
that? No?
I didn't know.
Okay. Mixture of six fats, mainly the horse, the hippopotamus, crocodile, cat, snake, and ibex to prevent hair loss. Again, clearly I have not been using that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're laughing at this. And besides, the whole point of this was so you'd be more attractive to the women, right? Well, I don't know if a woman would want to be around a guy wearing that stuff, but, you know. All right, here are some other medicines in Papyrus Ebers. Lizard's blood, swine's teeth, rotten meat, pigs, the moisture from pig's ears, literally. All right, and then excrement. Yes, even excrement. In fact, even human excrement used as medicine. So you got a little infection, you know, take some of that and just smear that on there. Okay. Now, I see Garrick kind of laughing, but this is, and I'm laughing too, but really this is not funny at all. This is not funny at all. The average lifespan in ancient times was around 20 years. Not because people couldn't live to be 100, it's because almost everybody died from some sort of an infectious disease. Okay? So, Exodus 15:26. Where God, through Moses, tells the people, if you will obey the laws I'm giving you today, you will not have the diseases of your neighbors. None of these diseases. He didn't promise eternal life, he said, but you will be healthier. You'll have less diseases. Okay? Now, so let's look at some of the commandments in Leviticus that point towards why that is the case. And think about it. How many cultures have a continuous history of at least 4,000 years? Okay, China, Egypt, India, and then the Jews. The Jews don't seem to fit that. You know, they're moving around and everything. Wow, how's that? I'm going to claim that at least in part, it's because of the restrictions in the book of Leviticus. Let me give you an example. Leviticus 11. The pig, it mentions others, is unclean for you. The wolves walk on the paws, the weasel, the rat, every kind of carnivore. And then there are a few kinds of meat they can eat. Beef, fish with scales, pork, definitely not. Okay?
Poultry.
Poultry, yes. Now, it just so happens that every meat on the don't eat list carries many, many diseases. And every meat on the okay to eat list is relatively safe. Pork has over 20 diseases, trichinosis being one, and pork is extremely dangerous. In fact, with modern hygienic approaches, even now, cook the pork through, okay? On the other hand, beef is relatively safe, even raw.
Yeah.
All right? Jan and I, we were in a restaurant in Venezuela a few years ago, and I ordered off the menu. I can read Spanish, but I said, just bring me that one. Big plate of raw beef. I'm thinking, all right, Leviticus 11. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Shellfish?
Heck no.
Bad idea. All kinds of foodborne illness problems. Fish with scales? Sushi? Yes. Now, if this was the only example in the book of Leviticus, it would still be pretty awesome. Because I'm telling you, all the people around them ate all of these things. And the Jews did not. And I guarantee you they had increasing health because of it. I guarantee you it's an undeniable fact. But if this is the only one, you can say, well, I don't know, maybe Moses got lucky or something like that. Or maybe, you know, maybe the Jews were good at medicine. That's kind of a racist thing to say. But let's just see if that might be true. Okay. Here is a Hebrew writing about, you know, sort of medical stuff. This is not in the Bible, though. It's not in the Bible, okay? Got it? All right, here we go. The gnat, feeble creature, taking in food but never secreting it. Let's stop right there. Basically, it's saying that gnats do not have poop. Now, is that true?
No.
That's not true. That's a science error. And I'm going to claim the Bible doesn't have a single statement like that. That's flat wrong. Okay? Is it specific against the poison of the viper? So I guess they had to keep gnats sort of around in a jar somewhere, because if you get bitten by a viper, you can't go out and catch gnats. So I guess they kept jars of gnats just in case. Okay? Sting of a hornet, healed by the housefly, crushed at a plague tomb, etc. So my point here is, right, if the Bible was what its enemies said it is, what that woman in that van said it is, then the Bible would have things like this. The Bible would have things like Papyrus Ebers, but it does not. Not even one. Instead, it has things like this. Whoever touches the dead body of anyone will be unclean for 7 days. He must purify himself of the water in the third and seventh day. Take some hyssop, dip it in the water. Ashes, hyssop, water. All right, great. So these are one of the laws of uncleanness. So what this meant is, if a relative of yours died, if you, for example, prepared the body for the funeral, you couldn't even attend the funeral. You were unclean for 7 days. Kind of a harsh, mean rule. Okay? Okay, fine. But think about touching dead bodies. Think about touching dead bodies. This guy, his name is Ignaz Semmelweis. In the 1830s and 40s, he was working in a hospital in Vienna. And by the way, I was teaching about Semmelweis in Hungary, and I told them at this thing he was Serbian. And somebody said, no, he's Hungarian. I said, I'm pretty sure he's Serbian. And they said, no, he's Hungarian. And they took me to his house there in Bucharest. So, all right, he's Hungarian. All right, he did live in Serbia for a while. He's Hungarian. But anyway, basically, he was working at a women's hospital. The death rate in the hospital was nearly 30%. Nearly 30% of the women who entered that hospital died in the hospital. Back in the day, women had their children at home, not because they couldn't afford to go to the hospital, but they couldn't afford to not go to the hospital. Okay? And so what he noticed is this practice that the doctors had, because this is when germ theory was first being proposed by Louis Pasteur. So what would happen is the doctors would come in the morning. It was called puerperal fever. It seems like a women thing. So the doctors would come in and examine the bodies of the women who died the night before. And they'd go immediately up to the wards and start, you know.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So he said, if you touch a dead body, you are unclean. You have to wash very, very thoroughly. And he had these special bowls so you could do them with your elbow and all this kind of stuff. The death rate went from 30% down to, like, I don't know, 5 or 6%. Okay, maternity wards, one out of every six women died, but it was higher in this hospital. Obstetricians said it's because of constipation, or they said the women are just hysterical. Typical men, you know, it's hysterical women. All right, anyway, oh, sorry, it was around 20%. Went down, but actually then some of us proposed another thing is, even when you touch a live patient, you have to wash yourself thoroughly before you go to another live patient. The Bible says when a woman gives birth, she's unclean. And when she has her period, she's also unclean. Why does the Bible say that? Because everybody knows God hates women, and Christianity is an anti-woman religion.
Yeah.
No. Because when are women in particularly susceptible to multiple diseases? When they're bleeding. Okay? So, with that measure, the death rate went down to about 0.5%.
Nice.
All right? They should have had a, you know, parade and all this sort of stuff, the hero of Vienna. Instead, a few months later, he got fired, died of a blood disease. All right. So anyway, let's talk about the formula. Ashes from the red heifer sacrifice, water, and the hyssop plant. The hyssop plant, and the oil of hyssop has something like 3% thymol. There's thymol. Now, you're not an organic chemist. Have you ever taken organic chemistry? Jen's taken organic chemistry. She's probably forgotten by now because, you know, it's been a few years. That's called a phenol. The little thing with the ring with the six things, and that's called a phenol. And when I teach about phenols, the first thing I teach about phenols is that they're antiseptic. So phenols are, they kill bacteria but are not poisonous to mammals. You know that hospital smell? Well, there's more than one smell, but that sort of, you know that sort of medicine-y hospital smell?
Yeah.
That's thymol.
Really?
Yeah. All right. In other words, the prescription when a Jew touched a dead body, by the way, if you take ash, water, and hyssop, it makes soap. All right. But it makes a powerful antibacterial soap. Ah, okay. There you go. All right, a couple more, and then that'll be enough because, oh, it's already 8:30. Okay. As long as he has the infection, he remains unclean. He must live alone. He must live outside the camp quarantine. Quarantine for certain skin diseases, specifically leprosy. Leprosy was the most feared disease in the ancient world, not because it killed more people. Typhus killed more people. Cholera killed more people. Many things. It wasn't the biggest killer, but it just killed in the most horrific way. All right, as you probably are aware, all right, they said it was due to things like eating hot food or, you know, the conjunction of the planets. They had no idea. And then in the 14th century, 15th century, something like that, some monks in Scandinavia were reading Leviticus, and they said, let's try that. Let's try this. And it worked. And within less than 100 years, leprosy had been virtually eliminated in Europe. Leprosy used to be common in Europe as well. But because of applying quarantine, it got rid of that disease. Okay, there you go. Again, why? When God gave these rules, he didn't say why beef but not pork. He didn't say why fish but not shellfish. He didn't say why. He just said do it. All right, and here's the principle. If you don't know why and you don't like the idea, just do it anyway, because otherwise you might die. It's a good take-home lesson here. All right, leprosy killed millions of people, blah, 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 fear of all other diseases. Can I compare it to it? Okay, great. Okay, good. Two more examples. The life of every creature is in his blood. Leviticus 17:14. That is why I've said to the Israelites, you must not eat the blood of any creature, because the life of every creature is in its blood. Anyone eats it must be cut off. Now, it's funny because these laws, even the whole thing of leprosy and the uncleanness, and there's like spiritual meanings kind of behind these things. Even the clothing of two materials, there's a spiritual lesson there the Jews got. So the life is in the blood. And that's kind of a spiritual meaning to us as Christians. But, all right. So basically, the Bible said the life is in the blood, therefore do not eat it, but also, there you go, bloodletting. The most common treatment for infectious diseases in the 18th and 19th century was bloodletting. The logic, the scientific logic of this was that the reason infectious disease spreads around the body is because it gets in the blood and through the blood it spreads around the body. It makes sense. Okay? So they thought, if you have a disease, you start draining out some of the blood. All right? The Bible said the life is in the blood. Medical science up until the mid-1800s said that the disease is in the blood. So who was right? Who was right, Gabriel? Who do you think? The Bible or science? He just said, I could read his lips. The Bible.
Woo!
Okay? Because the bottom line is, if you have an infectious disease, where is the solution found? In the
blood.
That's called your immune system.
White blood cells.
The last thing you want to do is remove those white blood cells if you have an infectious disease.
Uh-oh.
Last example, which is circumcision. This one's interesting. This doesn't come from Leviticus. This comes from Genesis. Right? This precedes the law of Moses. So when God said, you know, none of these diseases, he wasn't talking about this one, but this doesn't really have to do with the disease. It has to do with blood clotting. All right, for the generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. Okay, two things. Why circumcision? And then why the 8th day? Why circumcision? Well, think about it. Between bacteria, viruses, and yeast, which cause virtually all infectious diseases, Where do they like to, where do they thrive? Wherever it's warm and wet and dark. Okay. Where's the warmest, wettest, darkest place on a guy? Okay?
Yeah.
In fact, women were protected from death more than men in this case. How many lives were saved by male circumcision? In fact, a number of studies have shown that the spread of AIDS is lowered by something like 60%. Male to female. Male to female AIDS spread is reduced by a number of studies, anywhere I think between 40 and 60%. Don't quote me on that number. I haven't looked in a little while. Simply by male circumcision. So in Africa, in the early 2000s, they were on these male circumcising campaigns, which they don't do anymore because they've come up with some treatments for AIDS. All right, so there you go. But why the eighth day? Why not the first day? Why not maybe the 12th day, you know, number 12, the seventh day, the third day? Why the eighth day? Okay, well, I want to talk about vitamin K. I want to talk about prothrombin. By the way, prothrombin is the protein that actually causes the blood to clot. That's not the problem. The problem is vitamin K because vitamin K does not pass through the placenta. So when a baby is born, they have no vitamin K. So if you were to do a circumcision the day they're born, that would not be a good idea at all. Very large probability they would bleed out. By the way, whether you circumcise a male child now or not, it's of limited medical value today because the guys around here take showers, right? They take showers. So, you know, back then it was huge. Now it's you know, whether you should get a circumcision for your male child, I have no advice on that one way or another. But back then it made a big difference, all right? But now, like our son was circumcised, and it was probably like the second or third day. But when they're born, they give them a shot of vitamin K. One of the first things they do is give them a shot of vitamin K. Okay, so baby's born. Where's the vitamin K come from? It comes from bacteria in their gut. Well, where do they get the bacteria in their gut? From nursing off of mommy. Mm-hmm. All right? And so what happens is that vitamin K starts forming prothrombin. By the way, when a baby's born, they don't have zero prothrombin. They just have a fairly low level, all right, because the prothrombin can pass, but the vitamin K doesn't. So when the baby's born, the prothrombin level actually goes down because they don't have any vitamin K. Then it goes up to an unnaturally high level, and then it goes down to an equilibrium value. Look at that chart. From the day a child is born to the day they die, would you want to suggest a good day for doing a male circumcision? The ninth day is the ninth day and the seventh day, honestly. The plus or minus, the error on these data is too big to rule out the seventh or the ninth day. Okay, so there you go.
You could have been born at midnight or 12.
Yes. Yeah. So, ninth day, seventh day, okay. Probably the tenth day. There you go. How did Abraham figure this out? I think he did a double-blind experiment. What we're going to do is, for the next 5 years, we're going to circumcise on the first day. Then for the next 5 years, we're going to circumcise. No, that's not how it happened, okay? That is not how it happened. All right, so, conclusion. Number one, from science and the evidence for design in nature, it is an absolute slam dunk that there is a powerful, intelligent creator of the universe. To deny that is to deny essentially common sense facts about the universe. Now, I would say the argument from the Bible that from science that the Bible has inspired, that's a pretty strong argument. It's a pretty strong argument. But I would say other things like fulfilled prophecies, because this is a course on apologetics, right? Mm-hmm. So some of these other things, I think these are even stronger evidences, all right, that all scripture is inspired by God. Okay, so that's it. Unless there are any questions or comments.
I have a question.
Yes.
I have.
See you, Michael.
My dad. That leprosy actually in the Bible is more of a general term to apply to multiple skin afflictions?
Right. There were multiple skin conditions, one of which obviously was leprosy. And this thing did prevent the spread of leprosy and did save millions of lives. Now, were there skin diseases that were also treated through quarantine that possibly this quarantine didn't have as positive effect? I don't know enough about that to really comment. But it is true, he's pointing out a fact, which is the word in the Bible is not leprosy. The word is skin disease, and even talks about the nature of the, like the white, and all that stuff. Okay, I am not a sufficient expert to be able to give you a detailed response to that. I would say, though, that this advice saved millions of lives. So.
In that show, it is good.
I think Gabe.
Gabe, are you raising your hand? Yeah, go ahead. You have to unmute, though.
No, we have to turn up the volume.
Oh, turn up the volume there. Alright, studies have shown a surprisingly consistent level of belief in the broad idea of God among scientists. Because there was a study done in like the early teens, and one done, I believe, in the late 1990s. And the questions were, do you believe in some sort of intelligent design, sort of deism? And do you believe in theism, the idea of a God that intervenes? And the most recent one, I think it was around somewhere between 50 and 60% believe either in a theistic God or a deistic God. All right? So, nevertheless, atheists have an outsized effect on how scientists approach things. And there's this other thing, it's called Occam's Razor. Occam's Razor, which says what can be explained by less assumptions should not be explained by more assumptions. And applying Occam's Razor, by the 17th century, scientists were excluding supernatural explanations of things. For good reason, actually. All right, because essentially science became the study of natural history. So, supernatural is ruled out sort of almost a priori. And so that would explain partly because of the desire to coddle to atheists, but also partly because science itself excludes supernatural from its body of explanations. For both reasons, it shouldn't be too surprising that scientists did not go for a created universe until the evidence force them in that direction. I don't know if that answers your question, though, Gabe.
Yeah, it does.
It would not be natural for scientists to propose a creation event unless there was evidence. So I sort of argued it was this incredible bias, if you will, that made them believe in the eternal universe. And that's not a completely fair analysis. I think, although, on the other hand, a lot of scientists were Christians, so they definitely believed in a created universe. So, but the practiced exclusion of supernatural plus the outsized loud voice of atheists would explain why creation theories were excluded before the 1930s. See, there's a guy who's going to go off and be an engineering major at UCLA asking smart questions there. All right. I'll take only one or two more questions because it's getting late. Go for it.
Yeah. Is it possible that they have these weird, billion chances just so it's an excuse for them to kind of do what they want to do and they don't have to live by the laws of the Bible?
Who? All right. I see what you're saying. What you're doing is you're judging atheists' motives. And I believe God has the right to judge atheists' motives. So, for example, there in Romans 1:20, it says, they willfully ignore. Right? So I'd say, ask the atheist I'm not in a place to say, yes, is it possible that some people choose to ignore the obviousness of God because it means they'd have to change their life? All right, but is that the case? You know, I would say, ask the atheist why. And by the way, I was one. I didn't think I was doing it because I was trying to not behave properly. I don't know why I was an atheist. I think it's because I was a rebellious teenager. And whatever my parents believed, I was just going to believe the opposite. Plus, it was kind of attractive, you know, to think that you're kind of the best thing there is, you know? You're the top dog in the universe, humans. I don't know. I think, yes, there are people who choose to reject the obviousness of a creator because they don't want to admit that they're sinners. I think that kind of person exists. I'm not going to point out one individual who that is the case. I prefer to let people answer the question. And even if they're deceitful about the reason, I still think they should answer the question. Okay, up, Manny. You mean uranium?
Uranium, being in the sun. I always thought that the deeper you went into the ocean, the colder the water got. Because there's no sunlight to heat it. Right? But it seems like
as you dig into the earth, it's quite the opposite.
It gets warmer.
If you dig into the, yes, it gets warmer.
But it's like
the ocean gets cooler, but I don't know how much, after maybe I don't know the number. Say 300 meters, just a guess. After that, that's not the temperature gradient is not because of that. Okay? Because the sunlight does not go more than about, you know, there's below about 300 meters, there's no measurable sunlight. So the sun is not heating that water. So it is true, going from the surface down, the water gets colder in the summer, but in the winter, it's the opposite. Okay? So if you were to, for example, start at the surface of the ocean near Iceland and go down, it doesn't get colder. It actually gets warmer in the winter. All right, but, so, I'm not an oceanologist person. I'm an oceanographer, okay? So I don't know the numbers. But either way, for the earth, the crust of the earth, it definitely gets warmer as you go down. It definitely gets warmer. Ask anybody who works in deep mines. They'll tell you. You get down around 4,000 or 5,000 feet, which we have mines that deep. It's starting to get warm down there. Right? Yeah, heat is constantly escaping from the earth. Believe it or not, the earth gives off more heat than it absorbs. That's a fact. Yep. It just gives it off as infrared light, so you don't observe it. But the earth gives off slightly more heat than it absorbs.
So, my question is, can we still eat pozole?
You can still eat pozole. All right. Because you're not a Jew. But, if you were living 1500 BC, I'd say probably stay away from pozole.
Yeah.
However, if the pork is thoroughly cooked, it's even pork is relatively safe, thoroughly cooked. Yeah. But you were telling a joke anyway.
And also, the pork is prepared really carefully in America, like the way they freeze it. Kill off a lot of parasites.
Right. Pork, but even in America, still, unlike beef, where you can, you know, rare beef is, I mean, it's possible to get sick from rare beef, but it's very unlikely. Rare pork, don't even think about it. Don't even think about rare pork.
Yeah, it's medium rare pork steak.
And by the way, I eat raw mussels and raw oysters, but that's a terrible idea, actually. Okay. We better stop.
Yeah.
It's almost 9 o'clock. Jen, did you have a comment? Nope.
Gabe, it was great seeing you.
Hey, good hanging with you, Gabe. Gabriel, he's asking you what kind of engineering you're studying at UCLA. He might have muted. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Doubly. All right, schedules. Schedules for... Give out to people.
Oh, yeah.
All right, schedules for our events to give out to people. So what we give out at the table.
Raider, thank you.
All right, schedules for our events.
Hey, the ozone.
Right, these expire. At the end of... You should have zero of these left. You should have zero left.
The shower is good for you.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I learned.
That's good.
The shower is good for the other person that you are married to.
Even if I'm married, the shower is good.
Excuse me.
A time for 30, which is more than there normally is. Remember, that we're meeting at the administration building.
Right, and somebody needs to go to the old place, take those poster board things and carry them over to the new location. And you know what we should do? Somebody should put a 8.5 by 11 piece of paper on the door that says Merced Christian Church is meeting at Administration Building Room 2. Could somebody do that? In other words, go to the door of where we've been meeting. Huh? It's at the church website. I don't know. Maybe, hopefully, or text me. Room 2. So we need to put a little piece of paper on the window there to the door, and then we need to move the poster boards over. Because Jan and I aren't going to be there.
I'll be down in L.A.
Oh, what are you doing down there?
I almost lost you. I'm going to see my... This might be the last time I see one of my aunts. This might be one of my last times I'll see my aunt.
Oh, your aunt, is she dying?
It's getting there. So I'm
feeling it. All right. Oh, sorry about that.
4th of July is on the...
Oh, you did? Yeah, friend.
The lines are so...
No, for July 4th, the drum before thing in Clovis.
Remember there's a drum before show.
Yeah.
Clovis, but... Main thing is Gideon, the Ranger Horns. I think that'd be a great thing.
Alright, you decide. I mean, July 4th.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, July 5th. I'm sorry.
July 5th?
Yes.
Friday.
Saturday, yeah.
What about it?
So, I think people would actually be interested in from here to Clovis or Fresno.
Feel free to ask them.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not sure Drum and Bugle is like a big thing to, I mean, it is to you. Well,
to inspire others to hear what horns sound like.
Again, feel free to ask, and if people miss our Friday night event because they're doing that, I'm not going to make it. It's okay with me. I'm not controlling things like that. And so if you have a bunch of people want to do that instead of our Friday night thing, that's fine.
You feel like one of the... or whoever lost the battle.
I'm giving Josh a ride home unless somebody else is.
That's what I figured. Okay.
I was going to say, we'll give you one. We'll give you some bikes. Right on the handlebar.
All right. Well, then we should go.
We should. Because we're getting up early tomorrow morning.